This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore.
So your streak lives on. You still haven't screwed up that intro yet, which is quite impressive. Mind you, people would never know if you did or not.
Wait, what are you talking about? We just screwed it up.
No, you didn't screw it up. We mucked up where we went after you did the intro, but screw up the intro. I screwed up the coming in. Anyways, this is a pretty good episode. We covered a lot of ground. We talked at length about your interactions online with people commenting on your YouTube video and a Globe and Mail article, which quite incredible. So that's kind of a theme for this week. We talk a bit about that.
You could almost call it interactions with trolls, but they're really well thought trolls. We dive into this in the episode, but we didn't talk about what I'm about to say, that the people who are engaging in these discussions that are disagreeing with our evidence-based approach based on non-evidence, but they've got really well thought out non-evidence.
And they're aggressive about it.
Yeah.
I mean, they really are believers. So you have to love the enthusiasm. And a couple of people, they put a ton of time into debating with you.
I signed off on Friday. I wrote one last comment and said, you know, thanks for the chat, everyone. But I couldn't keep going.
Anyways, it's super interesting to read, super entertaining for us to see it. And yeah.
One thing that we don't have for this episode that we hoped to have is we filmed two episodes ago when it was just Cameron and I. And I mean, not a crazy amount of views, but about 200 people have watched it on YouTube, which tells me that at least some people are watching it. So if anyone's disappointed that we don't have video for this week, we apologize. We had just kind of rented the equipment last time to see if it would work, and we haven't actually gotten the stuff that we're going to use to film it going forward, but that's still something that will happen, just not today.
Right. Anyways, have a listen.
Welcome to episode 44 of the Rational Reminder Podcast. So it looks like we will probably hit 10,000 downloads for the show across all of the past episodes in the month of April.
And it goes up every month. It has every month since we started, which is kind of cool to see.
Yeah. And I guess the point of saying that is kind of just to say thank you to everyone who is listening. We do really appreciate that you are listening. We definitely appreciate when people reach out with comments and suggestions and questions.
But it's also interesting to observe where people get advice and who they take advice from. And that's kind of the common theme that goes through a few of the stories today, just with the interactions you've had on your article on Globe and Mail, as well as your YouTube channel, and who dispenses that advice is also interesting.
Yeah, well, I know that Dave Ramsey, the guy in the US that has a radio show and a YouTube channel, he took a bunch of flack recently, as did Susie Orman, for giving different advice that would generally be called bad. Like, Dave Ramsey loves promoting actively managed mutual funds, and he's got a huge following, and it's the weirdest thing ever.
Well, it's a highly rated show in Canada as well. Yeah. Always way, way above us. I'm sure he must have massive download numbers.
Oh yeah, his podcast is huge, definitely. Anyway, so sticking with the kind of new format that we rolled out for our non-guest episodes a couple of weeks ago, we're going to follow the same format today. So we're going to cover a couple of what we're calling current topics. One of those is a listener question with something that somebody reached out to us with. And then we've got our one portfolio management topic and our one financial planning topic. And then we'll finish off with the worst advice that we heard last week.
Yeah, we got a pretty good one this week, or a bad one, depending how you look at it.
Yeah. So the first topic we want to talk about is we asked last time we did an episode, We talked about some of the reasons that somebody might say index funds are not good investments. And as part of that discussion, we asked listeners if they had any other reasons that we hadn't thought of that people used to argue against index funds. And we got a bunch of people sent us notes, which was kind of neat to read, but there was one of them that I found the most interesting, I think. And that was somebody that said, well, an index is created by somebody. Like, people had to make decisions to create an index, which is what an index fund invests in, obviously. How is that different from an active fund? So he said that if I were an active manager, that's the argument that I would use against indexing.
Yeah, which is really interesting. Like, why would that necessarily be a bad thing if you're trying to capture capitalism?
Yeah.
Well, they're just blindly picking names?
I think the point is that in either case, you have delegated decisions being made. So why should an index be better than an active fund? That was the point of the person's question. But this is something that that's not a new thought. Great question. I'm not trying to offend our listener here, but
oh no, it comes up a lot. Absolutely, we didn't think of it last time.
That's not a that's not a new thought. There was somebody actually in Canada that wrote a paper about this. There's a paper called "Passive in Name Only: Delegated Management and Index Investing." And here's just a quote from the beginning of her paper. She says, rather than being passive in any meaningful sense, index investing simply represents a form of delegated management. Instead of being truly passive, tracking an index almost always implies choosing a managed portfolio. Not only are these indices managed portfolios in the strictly financial sense, by their construction, they imply a substantial amount of delegated decision-making authority. She's basically saying indexes are just actively managed, actively managed funds.
But I think it's safe to say they're within tighter rules, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think with an index fund, you're getting low costs and broad diversification, which is probably a good thing.
But there is decision-making going on behind the scenes, be it the S&P 500, be it any of the other indices. There is some sort of committee that is choosing what is in and what's not in.
Well, it depends on the index. Some indexes are committee-based, like the S&P 500 is the most well-known committee-based index. And I actually pulled a couple of sentences describing the S&P 500 and how the committee works. This is a quote. The index committee's mission in maintaining the S&P 500 is to represent the U.S. equity market with a focus on the large cap segment. The committee is not trying to pick stocks to beat the market. Rather, we use guidelines for stock selection, size, liquidity, minimum float, profitability, and balance with respect to the market to assure that the index is an accurate picture of the stock market. So they're trying to make it a representation of the U.S. market, but there are a whole bunch of different screens that go into picking the stocks that go into the index to be that representation.
Right. And by the way, it's delivered very nice returns, and you can get that for virtually no cost.
I think that's the biggest thing. It's a diversification and the low costs. Like, yes, in either case, you're choosing, you're delegating the decision-making of what goes into your portfolio, but with the index fund, you're getting diversification and you're getting low costs.
So you picked up some cool rules and some issues that have come up with some of the indexes that might explain why they're different.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were talking about committee-based indexes. And that's an obvious comparison to active management. But even when you have rules-based indexes, which are, as it sounds, they're based on rules, not based on any human decision-making. But even rules-based indexes can have differences. Like if you're investing in a FTSE Canadian index versus an S&P Canadian index, the methodologies to create those indexes can be materially different, which can obviously lead to a different...
And I didn't know about the telecom weighting that was so different. I hadn't realized that before.
Yeah, so while the FTSE Canada All Cap Index, which is what VCN tracks, they've got a foreign ownership restriction for security weightings, where they'll use that instead of free float to weight securities. And so what that plays out, how that plays out in the Canadian market with the FTSE Canada All Cap, is that you end up with a lower weight in telecoms because of the foreign ownership restrictions.
Which isn't necessarily bad, but it could mean tracking error or performance that is different from a broad index you might see.
That's the thing.
Posted.
So ex ante, like before things happen, looking at it now, there's no way to reliably say, well, this weighting methodology is going to be better or worse. But you're going to get, or you might get, you would be expected to get even a different result randomly. And it's the same kind of thing with, I looked at the Russell 3000 versus the CRSP US Total Market. They're both U.S. total market indexes, but the Russell cuts off at 30 million market cap, whereas CRSP U.S. total market cuts off at 15.
Yeah, it's not a formal rule that it cuts off. That's just where the 3,000th largest stock cuts off, right? So it's not a rule at 15 or 30 million. It's just that's where it happens to be, right? Because Russell 3000 peels off the largest 3,000 stocks, which ends up capturing, I think, 98% of the index,
right,
over the market.
So there's small differences in construction, but it can have differences, impacts in multiple basis points. Like I looked at the 12-month return for VUN and XUU, which are both U.S. total market. And over 12 months, it had a 43 basis point difference in returns, a tracking error between the two. If you're just an investor holding this asset forever, it doesn't matter because it's a random, it's a right, random tracking error. But where it starts to get interesting is if you're talking about tax loss selling, like you think about tax loss selling, you have to buy... Can't remember the tax term. Different,
a substantially different asset.
Yeah, it can't be the same. Non-identical properties. is the that's the term. So you can't repurchase an identical property within 30 days, 31 days of triggering a loss, which means you've got to go and buy something tracking a different index, because CRA quite a while ago had a decision or a guidance, whatever they call it, saying that two different index funds tracking the same index are identical properties. So the interesting thing about the tracking error is that you introduce this random risk of one index performing different from the other, which has to be a consideration when you're doing tax law selling.
Next topic?
Yeah, next topic.
I get a kick out of this, actually, just watching you interact with some of the people that follow you and comment on your article and YouTube. So the current topic is, who should you listen to? And it really made me wonder, as I look at a lot of these comments that of these people that engage with you, it makes me wonder where people get advice and where does all this passion come from? So you wrote an article last week on dividend investing that, man, you had a lot of interactions. What was it up to?
Well, I checked before we started talking here and it was 311 comments.
311 comments so far. And you try to engage with as many as you can, but boy, it took a lot of time just to read them, let alone for you to engage on that. And also last week, I came across an article written by Morgan Housel. This is what made me think about this, where he wrote this article that talked about how when you desperately need a solution, you will try anything and you'll believe almost anything to have that outcome happen. And he said, nothing is more true than in the world of investing. You know, so if you're way behind, for example, on your retirement savings, you will believe in lotteries. You'll believe in, you know, Hail Mary type investment strategies. I just thought that was really interesting. And then I linked back to some of the comments on your chats that were going on. And so many people are so fervent believers in their own experience, but they are out there trying to promote it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Morgan Housel in the article that you were talking about, he said, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, if there's a 1% chance that some advice, no matter how ridiculous the advice seems, will change your life, then it's not crazy for you to pay attention just in case. So tiny probability that it's going to actually help you. But even if there's a tiny probability that it's going to change your life, then you're not crazy for paying attention to it. But I think that in investing, I listened to a Sam Harris podcast a while ago, and I think it was Sam Harris. And it was just talking about the amount of information that is out there today and that we can't possibly absorb all of it. And so people end up following what I think he called tribal leaders. And once you have a tribal leader and beliefs that follow that, it's really hard to change your mind. And you'll be very willing to ignore good information.
Well, one of the quotes in Housel's article was, wanting and needing something messes with one's ability to gauge the likelihood of outcome. Because in all those comments, no one's talking about the probability of success. And you say all along, even a bad strategy can have a good outcome.
That's the thing. You start thinking about decision theory. You can't base a future decision on past outcome if there's no theoretical underpinning for that outcome. That's one of the things that I kept coming back to in those discussions was you can show me whatever you want. You can show me whatever past result that you want. But if there's no theoretical underpinning for why that is happening, you've got no reason to expect it to continue happening in the future.
Yeah. And then this conversation reminded each of us of the article that Josh Brown wrote.
It was a blog post, yeah.
Blog post called The Crucible, where he says, I don't think I would ever invest money with someone who isn't on Twitter, which I thought was really interesting to think about that, where for you to go out and make the comments and write the article that you did, I mean, you had to put a line in the sand, do your homework, and put something that was very thoughtful, and I don't think it was terribly controversial out there. But you knew it was going to poke the bear. And I think the Globe even told you that, right?
Well, you're saying you didn't think it would be controversial. The Globe warned me, like, we may not want to post this because you're just going to get blasted in the comments. Because I guess the Globe in general has people who are believers in dividend investing. And I didn't actually know this, but John Heinzel, who's a columnist for the Globe, he is a strong believer in dividend investing. I didn't know that. But in dividend investing, he is one of those tribal leaders where people – not that he's wrong, I'm not saying that, but people will just believe whatever John Heinzel says. And as soon as somebody says something different, which is what I did.
The tribe sure turned.
That's right. That's right. Despite the fact that I'm showing data and evidence, people don't want to believe in that because they already have their entrenched beliefs about dividend investing being the smartest thing ever.
So were you surprised at how mean some of the comments were?
No. I mean, I do this on YouTube every day. Pretty basic stuff at this point.
I know, but I mean, some of the comments that were made were just downright mean as opposed to trying to understand some of the points you were making. Because in our world, a lot of the points are not that from an academic standpoint, controversial.
No, I thought the fact that when I published that article, I don't get to choose the title, but the title that they chose was, I can't remember exactly, but they called me a contrarian. It was like, a contrarian argues against dividend investing.
Yeah.
And for me to be the contrarian, when if you look at the academic literature, I'm not the contrarian.
It was one of the people wrote, you deal in theories, I work with facts. Like, what do you do with that?
But it also raises the whole, when we're talking about taking advice or getting information from someone, if it hasn't gone through this review process, it's kind of like a peer review process in an academic journal, but way meaner on the internet. If you're taking advice from someone who has not published that advice online and left it open to criticism from other people, how can you possibly trust that advice?
I agree. I'm just reading some of the comments here that people have said, you know, like, even, you know, a theoretical underpinning. I'm guessing you're a single guy.
Yeah, I didn't understand that one.
I don't quite know how.
Is that because it's not rational to be married? I didn't get that.
I don't know. Even the basics, like, a dividend reduces the value of a stock.
Oh, that's
tautology. That's not debatable.
But that is one of the biggest points
livid with you.
Oh, furious.
You can't tell me the share price has to go down when it pays a dividend. Well, you're saying, well, mathematically it must.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it'd be arbitraged away forever.
Well, I think that we can actually, let's maybe end that discussion on whatever we were just talking about, tribalism and who to listen to online. I guess we didn't answer the question. Who should you listen to?
Our point is, we just try to explain the rational arguments for investing based on academic evidence. None of those debates that you had were based on any sort of peer-reviewed data.
No. Someone actually, and this is on YouTube, I had another very lively discussion on the YouTube video that I posted on Saturday, along similar lines though. And somebody over there, they made the argument for dividend investing based on the anecdotal example of them having bought Disney 20 years ago or something like that. And again, it's like, okay, you're justifying a strategy with the past outcome of something that has no theoretical underpinning. This stock did well, therefore dividend growth investing makes sense.
And you've said all along, you could have great outcomes from less than great strategies.
But who should you listen to? Yeah, well, like you said, I think that we're very strong believers that everything that we do and say has to be backed by not just empirical evidence, but also a theoretical backbone that explains the empirical outcome. Because without those two things combined, you don't really have anything.
But none of these people would ever change their mind, I think it's safe to say.
No. No, they were even within the comments in that discussion, there were even people rallying around other people saying, yep, you know, that they go and disagree with what I've said based on—
Of course, no one's using their real name. It's all aliases. You have no idea who these people are.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You haven't spent enough time on the internet.
Perhaps. Maybe don't have thick enough skin yet.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about that article?
Well, yeah. So let's transition into our portfolio topic for today. I still don't feel like we answered the question of who you should listen to.
I think we did.
Someone who's basing what they're saying on—
on evidence.
Evidence and—
make it understandable, which is kind of what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that's true. Because I guess the alternative is people just saying stuff.
Yeah. And you can get facts to show great outcomes. And we said earlier, people are willing to take a long shot on those things all the time.
You sent me one of the articles for our show today that was Barry Ritholtz had written, and he was talking about Susie Orman's advice to stop buying $4 lattes or something like that.
Yeah, you're—
she calls it the $1 million mistake or something. And Barry goes and looks at the numbers and says, okay, so I think Susie Orman says if $4 a day for 40 years, you'd have $1 million. And that's why it's $1 million error, not by buying, spending money on coffee at Starbucks or whatever. And Barry goes and looks at the math, and she uses a 12% rate of return to come to the $1 million number. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like she's just saying things. There's no reason to believe that a 12% rate of return is the right number to use.
And he says if a latte a day is ruining your long-term prosperity, you've got bigger issues than that latte a day.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I think that's enough on that. So the next topic that we wanted to talk about ties in kind of with what we were just saying, or at least it's a good segue. The portfolio topic for today is dividend growth investing, which is a highly, highly controversial topic, even though it shouldn't be. It still is. I did a YouTube video on this a while ago, and yeah, highly controversial. Plus the Globe article that we just did, highly controversial. People are very, very passionate about it. But the concept of dividend growth investors is that if you can find and understand really strong, good quality businesses that have historically increased their dividends over time, you can invest in those and you'll have a very reliable, safe, good outcome.
That sounds very sensible and very appealing and very understandable. And there's a whole lot of people that believe in it. So it becomes a very strong tribe, which can lead to great behavior, which is what the point you were trying to make, which is if you believe it this much, that's probably what's causing great performance.
That's the point I made in the YouTube video. Yeah.
Behaving well.
And there's merit to that. Really, there is.
Yeah. But the reality is it leads to weaker diversification.
Yeah. So I think that I made a few points in the Globe and Mail article that I thought we could just talk through here. So inherently, dividend investing leads to poor diversification, or at least reduced diversification. There's about 60% of the stocks in the US and about 40% globally. So call it half the stocks in the world do not pay a dividend.
At least.
So
And more are doing stock buybacks.
Yeah. So if you're deciding to constrain your investment opportunity set by dividend versus no dividend, you're cutting out half the opportunity set.
Yeah.
And we know one of the things that's super important in investing, this is one of the things that I was thinking about too that's really interesting. There's a big difference between an optimal investment strategy. Well, optimal is hard to define. You might get a better outcome picking dividend stocks than you would with index funds. You're giving yourself that opportunity by picking dividend stocks. The challenge is that you're increasing the dispersion of outcomes. If you go and pick 30 dividend stocks, you'll be expected to have a much wider dispersion of outcomes. You might get a much better result. You might get a much worse result. Now, we know statistically that you're more likely to get a worse result, but that's beside the point. With index funds, you're going to have a much tighter dispersion of outcomes. So now when we're talking about limiting half of the opportunity set, automatically, just by cutting out half the stocks in the market, you're going to have a wider dispersion of outcomes. The way that I would frame that is a less reliable outcome. And that's one of the things I kept coming back to in that whole internet debate was, why would you not want the most reliable outcome possible? But clearly, some people don't see it that way. So the next one is that picking dividend-paying stocks is unlikely to lead to investing success, which, I mean, picking any stock, regardless of whether it pays a dividend or not, picking any stock has a negative expected outcome because most stocks underperform the market.
I can just hear the dividend lovers exploding.
These are facts. Yeah. Come back to efficient markets. If a business is great and is going to continue doing well over time, that is already included in today's price. It has to do better than current expectations to beat the market. This is like grade one efficient market hypothesis.
Right. This goes back to the early 60s.
So how that gets missed, I don't understand. But that part of dividend investing is it hinges on markets being inefficient. Because the idea that you can pick an undervalued company, buy a great business at a great price or whatever they say.
But they're not looking to pick an undervalued company. They're looking to pick a great company that just has increasing dividends.
At a good price. That's part of it, at a good price.
Yeah, that's what they did say.
A dividend growth investor is not going to overpay for a stock. Come on now. They want to find a good deal. I was being facetious there.
Right. And then your other points were the dividends you're arguing against is the dividends are a guaranteed source of returns, which they're not.
Yeah. So I'm saying
dividends
that's false.
Can change.
That's
false.
That's not true.
The most popular one by far is dividends protect you in a down market. You get paid to wait, which I know you hear Kevin O'Leary say all the time. Why he loves dividend paying stocks.
But if we think about are dividends identifiers of strong and stable companies, no. The answer is no. When I did I can't remember the data points, but when I did the video for this, I looked at all of the companies that have done, that are doing share buybacks versus dividends. And if I remember correctly, it was a pretty even split of companies doing buybacks versus companies paying dividends. Those are two different ways of returning capital to shareholders. Why would a company that pays a dividend versus a company that is doing buybacks be a better investment? And the answer is that there is no...
I don't understand why.
There is no reason. So just identifying companies based on the fact that they're paying a dividend, it doesn't really tell you anything. And well, maybe it does tell you something. Maybe it does tell you it's a good business, but that doesn't mean that a company that's not paying a dividend can't be a good business.
Correct.
Which just comes back to that whole idea of limiting the opportunity set. The biggest one, well, you just said it, I think. I cut you off, but... The biggest one, I think, is that dividends are a guaranteed or at least a safe source of returns. When you receive a dividend, you've gained nothing. And now the heads are exploding. Now the dividend growth heads are exploding hearing me say that.
I just can't believe we said this so many times. If there was an opportunity, the market would arbitrage that away. If you could get the dividend, buy the stock, get the dividend, sell the stock at the same price, you would do that all day long. Just do it every quarter and leverage Leverage like crazy.
The value of a company is its book value plus the present value of future cash flows. And when a company pays cash out, its value is decreasing by the amount of cash that has been distributed to shareholders. The challenge, the reason this is so hard for people, I think, is that you don't see that reflected. Like the dividend gets paid, but then 1,000 other variables affect the price of the stock. So you don't necessarily see a dollar for dollar drop when the dividend is paid out. So dividend investors or people who believe in that, they think, well, no, the value of the company doesn't drop just because the price doesn't change dollar for dollar with the dividend. But the fact is, like valuation theory 101, dividend is paid, the value of the company decreases. So you as the investor, you receive the dividend, but you've got correspondingly less capital. You are net zero before taxes.
Okay, so that's enough about dividends.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's enough. People get it.
Well, it's worth mentioning that the whole idea of dividends protecting you in down markets. What I just said, if the stock price is down 10% and then it pays a dividend for 2%, you're going to lose another 2%. It's the same thing as if you sold off an additional 2%.
Yeah. Well, you get the 2% dividend, but yeah, the price has to go down.
But you got the cash. You've got less capital and you've now got the cash. It's the same thing as selling. Plus, companies can cut their dividends. So if you're using dividends as your spending rule, which I think is what dividend investors do, they don't use the 4% rule or whatever, which we're also going to talk about today. They use whatever the dividends are. So now you're letting corporate policy dictate what your retirement spending rule is.
Okay. Now I'm pulling you over to the planning topic.
Well, wait.
We're going to keep this rolling. Nah, let it go. Let it go.
But the last one is like the most important point.
Okay, fire away.
One of the biggest challenges for dividend investors is that when you look at dividend stocks, like if you look at the Dividend Aristocrats Index, which is an index of stocks that have grown their dividends over, I can't remember, 25 years or something, it's beaten the S&P TSX or the S&P 500. Why is that? We're saying dividends don't matter.
Random chance?
No, it's not.
Value?
Exactly. So dividend stocks tend to have, or at least have historically had, exposure to mainly two of the factors that explain differences in returns between diversified portfolios. So if you take a dividend growth portfolio, it will have a value tilt.
And profitability.
And it will probably have a profitability tilt, which is, it's actually really interesting because maybe you can actually get a value and profitability tilt using a dividend index. You're still limiting your opportunity set, I guess.
But don't let the dividend be the driver. Let the profitability and value be the driver. That's your point.
Exactly.
Be dividend blind.
Exactly. There's no reason to favor dividends because the advantage of dividend stocks is explained by value and is explained by profitability. All right, I'm done.
So last week we were driving out to record an upcoming podcast on the used car market, which as a side was a fascinating interview.
Yeah.
So we were in the car and we decided to listen to a Tim Ferriss show where he interviewed Mr. Money Mustache. And boy, we're not intending to be hard on the FIRE movement, the financially independent retire early movement, but there are some things that were said on that podcast that really made us scratch our heads.
We should be very explicit that today we're not being critical at all of FIRE. We've heard from listeners, I mean, in some cases, almost pleaded with us to take it easy on FIRE.
And in fact, if someone knows a great FIRE representative, we'd love to have one on the show.
I think we should get Mr. Money Mustache.
He'd be great. He's a connection to Ottawa too.
Yeah.
He was a very interesting podcast. It's just the math, that 4% rule in today's day and age just seemed to be a little...
Well, it doesn't seem to be. These are facts. Like,
but I went back to his old website and even there's a quote on there that says the shockingly simple math behind early retirement. And you can almost say it's shockingly wrong now.
Well, it is. It is shockingly wrong. Now, he does have some, I don't know what you'd call them, caveats that being flexible with spending and being able to work a little bit. And for him, I mean, come on, I'm sure he's making decent money from his.
Yeah, because what was his spending budget? It was not a lot.
$24,000 a year or something
like
that.
And he has a 9-year-old child, I think. So a couple of 9-year-old child. But he has other sources of income. And he even said in his website, you know, he's got, you know, rental income, his portfolio, his government benefits. He could reduce his spending. He could pick up some side work. So he does have a bunch of escape hatches if things don't go well.
But the thing that I really wanted to hit on was the 4% rule, because I think that I almost feel like I have a public service duty to tell people how irresponsible it is to use the 4% rule as a spending rule for your retirement goals. To me, it's completely insane. When you think about
And the younger you are, the worse it is.
That's the problem. So where did the 4% rule come from? It came from a guy named William Bengen. He wanted to figure out how to responsibly coaches clients on spending money from their portfolio. So he did something that was really neat that nobody had done at the time. And he went and did historical analysis using data. And this is, like I said, when at the time that he did this, this had not been done. So he took a hypothetical portfolio using S&P 500, 50%, and U.S. intermediate term government bonds, 50%. So 50% stocks, 50% bonds using U.S. S&P 500 data. And he looked at rolling 30-year periods, starting in 1926, ending with 1992. So that's 1926 through 1955, followed by 1927 through 1956. So 30 years, 30 years, 30 years.
Yep.
Moving forward, each 30-year period, 1 year, with the last year being, or the last 30-year period being 1963 through 1992. What he was looking for was what was the maximum safe withdrawal rate in the worst 30-year period in U.S. history? And that is where the 4% rule comes from. So the worst 30-year period, I didn't write down which 30-year period it was, but in that worst 30-year period, you could have spent 4% without running out of money. So boom, there it is. 4% rule is born. And it's become now this massive thing.
Okay, so what's the problem with that analysis?
Okay, so number one, he's using S&P 500 data. We know now, ex post, that the S&P 500 has been the best performing index in history. Market cap index. I'm sure there are better niche indexes. But anyway, if you repeat this exercise, the 4% rule analysis, the 30-year rolling period analysis, if you repeat that with global stocks, still using historical, you get 3.5% as a safe withdrawal rate.
And how do fees factor into this?
This is all pre-fee. No fees. Now, with ETFs, fees are almost negligible.
Okay, but for an advisor charging 1% or 1.5%?
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't work at all.
Well, really, I mean, it completely demolishes the 4% rule.
Which is why FIRE people would never use an advisor. But they also might run out of money if they're using the 4% rule. Sorry,
he was using actual data, actual performance from actual years. There was no sort of going back and doing any sort of Monte Carlo randomization of returns.
No, so 4%, the analysis done for the 4% rule initially was historical analysis, not Monte Carlo. So that's one of the other things that you can do. But before we get there, I think that the big thing that's important to understand with the 4% rule is that 30-year period. So it's those rolling 30-year periods. If you change that to using the same data, US data, 50% intermediate bonds, 50% S&P 500, but if we go 40-year periods instead of 30, the failure rate at a 4% withdrawal rate is 15%.
This is using real data?
Yeah.
Wow.
So you just extend out by 10 years and 15% of the time, you run out of money spending 4%.
So that's the real issue for the FIRE people because they're retired longer than 30 years.
But that's correct.
They're retired like 50 years, well, even more.
So if you go 50 years, that was looked at as well. If you extend out to 50 years, the failure rate increases to 30%.
Crazy.
So now in 30% of historical periods, spending 4% over a 50-year retirement period.
And this is actual failure, let alone any sort of Monte Carlo looking forward with any sort of assumptions failure.
This is historical actual failure, yeah.
Wow.
Now, the next step is, because this is also using historical data, expected returns now are maybe lower than they've been in the past. So the next thing that you can do is start looking at Monte Carlo. It doesn't actually change that much when you start looking at Monte Carlo, but we did look at a 55-year retirement period using Monte Carlo and found the safe withdrawal rate was just over 2% for 50 years. Now, this is all assuming you never work again, that you fully withdraw from your portfolio, whatever the percentage is, every year, regardless of conditions.
That you're spending in a bad year, which I think a lot of people would do.
Yeah. So once you start factoring that stuff in, I think the 4% rule could be a fine starting point, but you've got to understand that that's what it is, yeah. A starting point.
4% knowing you have to go down to maybe 2 or 2.5% in a bad year.
You can't get to the point where you can spend 4% and you're good. That's not how it works. That's not how it has worked in the past anyway. Maybe the future is going to be different.
Yep.
You start talking about other sources of income. And of course, that's why do you think so many people who are big FIRE advocates are also big FIRE bloggers?
Yeah.
It's an alternative source of income, which is fine. And I'm not saying anything negative about the FIRE movement. So 4% rule, not so much. Maybe 3.5 for a 30-year retirement, maybe less for a longer retirement.
So worst advice from last week, there's an article in the Globe and Mail that that kind of caught our eye called When Mutual Funds Make More Sense Than ETFs. So my first comment, what drives me crazy is that people equate active management with mutual funds. I hear this all the time. New people come in to meet us. I don't want mutual funds. Well, it's not about mutual funds. There's nothing wrong with a mutual fund structure. It's a great structure for all kinds of reasons.
We talked about this with Rob Carrick, where he wrote an article saying the exact same thing. Like the TDE series mutual funds are fantastic. Low-cost index funds, but they're mutual funds. But that doesn't mean you should be scared of them.
Yes. Mutual fund is a structure. It's not a strategy. So it gets right out of the gate. That kind of rubs me the wrong way. But then they go and, I mean, it's all about, I guess, the fact that ETFs now have greater net sales than mutual funds, even though mutual fund assets in Canada are at least 8 to 10 times larger than ETFs. But they go around interviewing a bunch of different advisors to get their feedback on this. And some of these quotes, I mean, get this one. In later stage markets, a good actively managed mutual fund can maximize returns and limit volatility more than an ETF can and alleviate the emotional ride for investors on the downside. You just love that one, don't you?
This article was insane. And now that same advisor was quoted again as saying, clients don't mind paying a little bit extra in fees if they feel their portfolio is being managed actively, particularly when markets are more turbulent.
And we know how much Ben likes the word feel.
Hey, feelings are important. You can summarize it as, in some cases, actively managed mutual funds are better, in some cases being times where markets are potentially going to drop. But it's actually good timing for this discussion because we just posted a YouTube video on Saturday talking about this exact same thing, about what the arguments against index funds, the same kind of stuff that they were saying in this article, that mutual funds, actively managed mutual funds are going to protect you in bear markets because skilled active managers can whatever they can do. But in the video, we showed all of the data explaining why that is not the case. And you're still going to have a much more reliable outcome using the diversified index funds compared to an active fund.
And don't forget another quote here, ETFs don't rebalance on their own, which means investors need to stay on top of the trades to keep their portfolio balanced.
I guess they haven't heard of VGRO.
Go buy VGRO or VBAL and it's all done for you at whatever, 18 or 20 basis points.
It's crazy to me that information like this still gets published and it's crazy that people still eat it up. But I think that the craziest part about all of it is that people don't just eat it up. But if you look at the investment fund assets in Canada, almost 90% of them are still in actively managed funds.
I'd love to know what the weighted MER is of it.
The whole Morningstar looked at it, I think, a couple of years ago, and it was 2.02%. Good. So it's come down. It's come down a bit.
Yeah, maybe 20, 30%, which is better. Anyways, that's our bad advice of the week.
Yep. So worst advice from the week was that mutual funds make sense sometimes. Well, sorry, I'm being the bad guy. Actively managed mutual funds make sense sometimes. And our feedback on that is that No, they do not.
Anything else on your mind?
Nope. I think that's it. You?
Nope. Great guest next week. Dr. Moira Summers is up next week.
Yeah, that'd be a good episode. Or it was a good episode.
It's very good.